Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast, one of the few things on this continent of Europe that you can continue to consume week by week without worrying about the price going up.
Yay!
But Katie, did you hear about these videos going viral on TikTok in Germany with people hunting down the most ridiculously priced cucumbers?
Why cucumbers? This was my first question.
I guess because there's something that you expect to be really cheap and people are finding them on sale for like €3.29, I saw in one of the videos.
€3.29. It's just water. It's water made solid with a bit of green stuff.
I know.
It's outrageous.
I mean, I can't say I'm surprised. I bought a broccoli for €3.75 the other day.
Oh my God.
So the cost of living crisis, or cozy lives, as the kids are calling it in the UK, it's not ready to wind down yet. What ridiculously expensive food have you bought this week?
Well, do you know what? I feel like prices have been noticeably going down in supermarkets here in France over the past few weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it has felt very relieving. And actually, most of the chains have just agreed to do this thing called the anti-inflation basket. Where they're going to slash the prices of a bunch of basic things, which seems good. I'm trying not to be cynical about it, but, you know, we'll see how long it lasts.
That sounds great. We all need to move to France, apparently.
Come on over. Before we get into this week's show, we just wanted to send our love and support to those dealing with the aftermath of last week's terrible train accident in Greece, which happened just after we recorded last week's show. We are following the protests over here, and it does seem like the situation is developing quite quickly right now. So we're not going to be speaking about it at length this week. We're hoping to come back to what happened and how the authorities are dealing with it in a forthcoming episode. But this week, we're going to be talking about Moldova. Why Moldova, Dominic?
Well, because it's a country that borders Ukraine and has been pretty pro-European in recent years. They were actually granted official EU candidate status last year. But some things have been happening there over the last few months that are looking really rather worrying. There are even rumors of plans for a Kremlin-backed coup. And Putin also recently repealed a 2012 decree recognizing Moldova's independence. So that, combined with the fact that there have been pro-Russian protesters marching in the streets in recent weeks, meant that we thought it was time to look at Moldova. We wanted to know how worried we should be and how to interpret what's going on there. So to help us do that, we have invited the brilliant Ivana Stradna, a special correspondent for Kyiv Post and a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, to join us later on in the show. But first, it's time for
Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
Well, I've got a rather weird story for bad week. It's been a bad week for the teenage founder of an airline, or an almost airline, called Bavarian Airlines. This airline started cropping up in airline industry media at the start of this year. I'm sure you noticed, Katie.
Oh, yeah, glued to the stuff.
It was to be based out of Munich Airport, and the founder talked about having planes, leased aeroplanes, up in the air by the end of this year, complete with a reward scheme that would apparently reward frequent flyers with crypto. It was going to be flying routes to Amsterdam, Milan, London City Airport, Berlin, Düsseldorf, and Vienna. So on most of those routes, it was going to be placing itself in direct competition with Lufthansa, the flag-carrying airline of Germany.
Ballsy move.
Yeah.
But how was it going to compete with Lufthansa? Like, what was its, you know, unique selling point?
Well, it had this cryptocurrency thing, which was headline-grabbing. But according to its website, Bavarian Airlines is a premium airline that offers a superior level of comfort and convenience for its passengers. We provide luxurious amenities and attentive service to ensure a stress-free and enjoyable travel experience.
Sounds lovely.
It does, but don't head to your browser and try and book, because after some pretty bonkers reports in the German media this week, it seems pretty unlikely that any of that is ever going to happen. Most of the reporting has been focused on the founder of the airline, an Estonian-Swiss teenager. Quite how old he is still an open question. It had been reported that he was 18, but that is one of the bombshells from the reporting this week. It seems like he's probably younger, and possibly even as young as 15.
Can a 15-year-old run an airline?
No, it would seem that a 15-year-old is not allowed to run an airline. So if he is indeed 15, as media reports are suggesting, and has lied about his age, then he could be in some quite big trouble. The expose was reported by a German podcast called Air Crash, along with Business Insider. And along with the allegation that he lied about being an adult, he's also being accused of faking bank documents. One of his investors is planning on filing for commercial fraud claims. There are also accusations from a real estate agent who is also accusing him of fraud. There's a lot of different strands to this.
I have so many questions. Like, how did he even convince investors to get on board with this? Like, as soon as you meet a 15-year-old, either face-to-face, wearing a little teenage business suit, or on like a video call with his teenage bum fluff on his face, like, wouldn't it be extremely obvious that you were dealing with a 15-year-old?
Yeah, you'd hope so. Apparently some people are willing to invest in anything, and he seemed like a prodigious talent. But one of my favorite details about this is how the journalists discovered that he's probably not 18. And one of the key pieces of evidence they collected was local newspaper reports of the teenager in taekwondo tournaments in 2018. And the reporters discovered he was in the C class in 2018, which you can only be in when you're aged 10 to 12.
Oh.
So that would make him somewhere between 15 and 17 now. And that evidence was then backed up by a LinkedIn profile that he had, which said he would graduate from high school in 2026, suggesting that he's probably at the lower end of that 15 to 17 age range. Mm. The teenager, who I've decided to continue calling the teenager, because if he's actually a child, it feels a bit unnecessary to name him, even if he allegedly defrauded people. Mm. Anyway, the teenager has denied all these claims that were put to him by Business Insider, and denies also that he's even lied about his age, which I find a bit confusing because I thought that would be something that would be quite easy to clear up, just checking his documents, but he's also being accused of falsifying documents.
Right.
So I guess it's a bit more complicated.
This just makes me think about how, like, you know how teenagers are always doing stuff on their computers in their bedrooms and their parents are like, you know what? I'm just going to assume that you are watching porn. Can you imagine finding out that your teenager was actually not watching porn, but pretending to be the founder of a new airline and like potentially getting into like debts of hundreds of thousands of euros?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Pretty horrifying. And he could actually be in some quite serious trouble. He was apparently picked up by the police at Düsseldorf Airport last week, only briefly detained and then let go. But there are multiple people and organizations saying that he owes them quite a lot of money. I mentioned his investor, who says he is owed money, having paid for loads of hotels and flights and business meals for him. And there's this real estate agent that thinks they've been defrauded. But there's also an organization called Universal Airlines, who were going to run the service for Bavarian Airlines. And they say they have an unpaid invoice of 300,000 euros. The teenager says he's paid it, but Universal Airline boss says he hasn't. So if this reporting is all correct, the guy owes a lot of money. Before the article came out, the teenager was confronted by the investor guy. And since then, the website of Bavarian Airlines has been down or in maintenance mode. So it seems like the game might be up. But it's such an extraordinary story. And also, I think, quite a sad story about this prodigious young guy who seems to have got himself into quite a pickle.
And he's obviously really smart. I kind of hope he can get everything sorted out and then have a bright, non-crimey future.
Yeah, use his intelligence for some good instead of creating an airline that doesn't really seem to exist. If you want to read more, I will link to a blog post from One Mile at a Time, which gives a bit more detail than I have time for, but in a very accessible way. Thank you to our longtime listener, Britta, for sharing that blog post with us and bringing this wild story to my attention. It's yet another case of a listener sending us something that we would otherwise not have heard about. So thank you.
Thanks, Britta.
I can't wait to see the biopic of this teenager's life.
Oh, yeah. It'll be like Catch Me If You Can, but in the crypto era.
Maybe he can make all the money back that he owes these people by selling his film rights.
It's not a bad solution.
Who's had a good week, Katie?
Well, there was a good argument for giving good week to Kaja Kallas, the Estonian Prime Minister, who seems to have done very, very well in her country's elections at the time of recording. That would have been the serious option. But instead, because everybody needs a bit of light relief, I am going to say it has been a good week for protecting the national brand of Switzerland, which sounds very boring, but I'm delighted to tell you that this is actually a story about chocolate. Namely, my favourite chocolate in the entire world, I think, which is the iconic triangular Swiss chocolate bar packed with honey and almonds, the Toblerone. Are you a Toblerone fan?
I am a Toblerone fan, yeah. I wouldn't say it's my favourite chocolate ever.
Oh, I love them. I actually bought two of those giant Toblerone bars, you know, the ones that they sell at like airports. I bought two of those at the beginning of the pandemic. And every time I was having a particularly sad day during the first COVID lockdown, I would have myself a big fat triangle and the world would seem a little bit brighter. So I kind of associate Toblerones with COVID and sadness now, but they are delicious. Why am I talking about Toblerones this week? Well, you know the Toblerone packet? It's sort of beige, has this comforting leaf.
Beige? Yellow?
It's beige. I'm Googling it right now.
Me too.
Oh, it's sort of...
Having second thoughts?
It's, I would say, parchment colour.
It's like a goldy yellow. It's kind of like a gold bar.
Parchment colour. Anyway, you know the packet. You may or may not know that it has on it a picture of the Matterhorn. The Matterhorn being one of the highest mountains in the Alps, right on the border between Switzerland and Italy. The Matterhorn is, in fact, a very symmetrical mountain. And I always kind of assumed that the Toblerone chocolate bars were triangle-shaped because they're supposed to look like the Matterhorn. But that apparently is probably an urban legend. The mountain has only been on the packet since 1970. But in any case, Dominic, say goodbye to the Matterhorn because it is no longer allowed to appear on the Toblerone packet.
That's tragic.
It is tragic.
Why?
So glad you asked. It's because of a quite interesting law that was passed back in 2017, which laid down quite strict criteria for whether or not you could market a product as Swiss. And that is because retailers can charge loads extra for products that are made in Switzerland or appear to be made in Switzerland because of the general association between Switzerland and quality, especially for luxury products like watches. Back in 2017, when the government was passing this legislation, they cited this research by two Swiss universities, ETH and St. Gallen. And the researchers found that people were willing to pay up to 50% more for a Swiss-made watch. And, you know, anyone who's visited Switzerland will know it is a very expensive country. So stuff made in Switzerland is just more expensive in general because their labor is more expensive, everything is more expensive. But there is also this very strong association with Swiss stuff being well-made, especially luxury goods like watches, but also certain food products, especially chocolate. So the Swiss government doesn't want things that aren't actually made in Switzerland to be able to pass themselves off as Swiss, because it means that they can free ride off the strength of this reputation without necessarily having the costs associated with producing in Switzerland. What does that mean? Mostly, it means that if you don't produce in Switzerland, you can't slap made in Switzerland, product of Switzerland on your label. And you can't use the Swiss flag or otherwise imply that your product is Swiss if it isn't.
Which kind of makes sense.
It does make sense.
But isn't Toblerone actually Swiss?
A very good question. Toblerones were invented by a Swiss chocolate maker called Theodor Tobler and his cousin, Emil Baumann. And it was Tobler who gave the bar its name. The word is a combination of his name, Tobler, and torrone, which is what Italians call nougat. Other Europeans might know this stuff as toro or turon or turon. And Toblerone bars have been made in the same factory in the Swiss capital, Bern, since 1908. And a fun Bern-related fact, if you look closely at the mountain on the Toblerone packet, you will see there is a little outline of a bear inside the mountain, and that is a symbol of the city. Toblerone was bought by the American company Mondelez in 2012. They're one of those absolutely giant companies that owns many, many snack brands. They own everything from Ritz crackers to Oreo cookies. And Mondelez announced last year that from the end of 2023, they will be moving some of their production of Toblerones to Slovakia to save some money. Mondelez already makes Milka chocolate in Slovakia. That's another brand that used to be Swiss and isn't anymore. And it's not really clear how much of the production of Toblerones they're planning on moving to Slovakia, because they have said that they want to keep this very historic factory in Bern open. But it's definitely enough of the production moving to mean that they can't brand Toblerones as Swiss anymore. Because under these Swissness rules, it specifically says that for chocolate, the cocoa doesn't need to come from Switzerland because obviously it isn't grown there. But 100% of the milk products need to come from Switzerland and everything needs to be processed there. So Toblerone are clearly not allowed to try to pass themselves off as being produced in Switzerland anymore, which means the box can no longer say Swiss chocolate, Toblerone of Switzerland. They're going to change that line on the packet to established in Switzerland, which is, you know, still true, I guess. But as for the picture of the mountain, I spent a stupid amount of time reading the rules in German, and I couldn't find anything specifically saying that you can't use a picture of the Matterhorn, and the mountain is right on the Italian border. So
yeah,
maybe they could get away with it. But I mean, you know, it is a symbol that is very much claimed by the Swiss as Swiss. And I did find this government guideline document complaining about companies that aren't Swiss using the Matterhorn as a symbol. Mm. So evidently the Toblerone lawyers have decided it is probably not worth the risk of carrying on using it. So it's going to be replaced by a slightly less distinctive looking mountain. And the font is changing, apparently. But I don't think Toblerones are about to become, you know, completely unrecognizable on the shelf.
Are they about to become cheaper? Because they won't be Swiss anymore.
That would be nice.
But, and also, wasn't there something about them getting smaller?
Well, there was a scandal in our home country of the UK back in 2016, not long after the Brexit vote, when Toblerone bars in the UK started having a different shape. A worse shape, if you ask me, with a bigger gap between each of the triangles that just made the bar look a lot less generous. And the whole bar got lighter by 20 grams, while the price stayed the same. And so naturally there was fury amongst consumers that they were being cheated out of their chocolate. And there were a lot of suggestions at the time that, you know, this was the reality of Brexit, smaller, crapper chocolate bars. Mondelez, the parent company, they said it didn't have anything to do with Brexit. Although at the time, a lot of brands were raising their prices in the UK because Brexit was making the value of the pound plummet. It should also be noted, though, that Mondelez also cut the size of Toblerone bars in Germany a year later. However, in 2018, Toblerones went back to being their original shape without this silly large gap between each triangle. So the customers won. I don't know. I mean, the skeptical side of me thinks that these controversies around food brands, I think the brands actually quite like them because it's free publicity. Like apparently after the UK Toblerone scandal, sales actually went up because all of these news stories reminded people, oh, Toblerone exists. I could eat a Toblerone. I'm going to go and buy one. And no doubt the same is going to happen as a result of us talking about Toblerones today and all of these news articles that have been written about them having to take the Matterhorn off the packet. But you know what? I do not begrudge them for it. It is a delicious chocolate bar, whether it is fully made in Switzerland or part made in Slovakia. And all of this research has made me very hungry. So I'm going to go and buy one.
You're officially endorsing Toblerone. Time for us to do that awkward thing and ask you for money. If you value what we do here and would like to keep us going, please think seriously about becoming a Patreon so that this podcast can go on. Katie actually quit her job a while back to dedicate her time to making this show, and we need to pay her and myself and the wonderful producers, Katz and Wojciech. So anything you can give is much appreciated, from as little as €2 or dollars or pounds a month. So please head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast if you are able to join.
Big, big thanks go to our newest supporters, Robert Flights, Leonardo Mosca, Neve Homps, Antoine Marlot, Evan Lee, and Malvina. Huge thanks go to all of you. Let's go to Moldova. There have been some pretty worrying reports in recent weeks out of the country. Really alarming warnings from the president, Maia Sandu, of some kind of coup plot. And then all of these anti-government protests and suggestions that these protests are being encouraged by Russia in some way. And even some suggestions that Russia is eyeing up some of Moldova's territory. Moldova is, of course, one of Ukraine's immediate neighbours. It also shares a border with the EU via Romania. And honestly, we weren't really sure to make of any of this. Like, what is Russia up to here? Do we know for sure that Russia is up to anything? we thought we'd better speak to someone who knows a lot more about this than we do. So we rang up Ivana Stradna. She is a special correspondent for the Kyiv Post and a researcher at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in the US. And her work focuses on Russian information operations. So how Moscow uses everything from propaganda to cyber warfare to pursue its interests. And she has been following what's happening in Moldova with great interest. So she seemed like the perfect person to speak to this week. We were very happy to speak to her from Washington, D.C.
There's been a wave of anti-government protests in Moldova in recent weeks. What does Russia have to do with these protests? How sure are we that Russia has played some role in them?
So what we know so far is that the Ukrainian intelligence, they recently announced that Russia would actually interfere in Moldova and try to overthrow the government. And that happened around a time when Moldova Prime Minister resigned due to numerous, you know, crises caused by Russian aggression in Ukraine, but also their energy blackmail. And then President Maia Sandu, she confirmed this statement that was put forward by the Ukrainian intelligence. And not only that, she described the scheme like completely in detail, actually explaining how they plan to attack the government buildings and seize hostages with the assistance of citizens from Russian Federation, Belarus, Serbia, and Moldova. So what we know so far is that the intelligence actually confirmed Russian interference. When it comes to protests, what we know is that it perfectly fit what Ukrainian and Moldovan intelligence explained. And this particular protest that we experienced in Chișinău was actually organized by a group calling itself like a movement for the people. And it was supported by Moldova's pro-Russian party. Russia does not need to create protests. What they really need to do is to exploit already vulnerabilities that exist in Moldova, because that's part of Moscow's playbook. Putin does not need to roll on tanks in Moldova. He's perfectly happy to organize chaos over there and to distract us from Ukraine.
You mentioned energy, and obviously it feels like people pretty much everywhere have been dealing with a rise in the cost of living. But in Moldova, things have been particularly bad. The country was completely dependent on Russia for natural gas before the war, and after the invasion, Russia cut supply. I imagine that's something that has contributed to this tense atmosphere in the streets and maybe contributed to the protests.
Absolutely. Moldova has been dependent on Russian gas, which allows Moscow to use gas as a weapon. And imagine, in the middle of the war, in the middle of economic crisis, as a family, when you receive an energy bill that you cannot afford to pay, how much dissatisfaction within the population it causes. And that's precisely how Russia has been using that to mobilize people to join protests on the street and to challenge Maia Sandu's pro-Western government. Whenever people tell me that this war in Ukraine was triggered because Ukraine wanted to join NATO, let me remind you that Moldova has always been a neutral country. So whoever buys that argument, Moldova is a perfect example that being a neutral country, something that would suit Russia's interest, even that cannot prevent them from waging their hybrid war.
This term hybrid war, I've been hearing it quite a lot in reference to Moldova. I was wondering if you could break it down a bit. What exactly do we mean? It's kind of self-explanatory, but it's also one of those things I think that you hear and you don't really think necessarily about what it means if you're not studying it every day.
The hybrid war is a term very popular after 2014, Russian invasion in Ukraine and what happened, you know, in Crimea. So everyone started talking about hybrid war, but it's really nothing new because that has been the part of Russia's military over past, you know, several decades. So what hybrid war really means is the use of weaponization, for example, of information space. And in addition to that, the use of kinetic use of force. So it combines the two, which is exactly what we see right now happening in Ukraine. Russia understands very well that whoever controls the information space can win the battlefield. And this is why they've been investing tremendously in asymmetric tools to challenge the West. Because, look, I always like to see all of us who are doing research related to information war. People like to label us as conspiracy theories because you cannot see information as a weapon, but you can see Russian missiles. And indeed, information is the weapon, which is part of Russia's also weaponization of refugees, Russia's weaponization of energy, what we were just talking, the weaponization of food crisis in Africa, where Lavrov usually likes to go there and to blame the West, you know, for the food crisis that might actually cause the social unrest and then the flow of refugees back to Europe. So it's very complex and it works and it's real. The fact that you cannot see it, it doesn't mean that it's not dangerous. On the contrary, every time when Russia wants to use kinetic use of force, the prelude to that is actually information war that also continues throughout the rest of their military strategy when it comes to hybrid war.
So it does seem like Russia is using some of these tactics in Moldova. In the face of everything that's going on, do you think that Moldova is receiving enough support from allies like the United States and the European Union? What else could Moldova's allies be doing in this situation?
To begin with, we need to recognize what Russia really wants there. Russia has been trying, because of the poor performance on the battlefield, to distract the West. And the best way to do it is to find alternatives. So Moldova is an easy pick for them. And by creating chaos over there, so Europe and the United States and other NATO allies spend time, energy, and resources on Moldova instead of having a laser focus in Ukraine. We should be doing more. To begin with, we need to economically help the government of Moldova because they are really suffering huge economic losses and problems. We definitely do need to help them with the energy sector. It's going to take a long time, but better that we start in 2023 than to wait additional time. We should send them hybrid warfare teams to help them with cybersecurity issues and fighting Russian information space, because I wouldn't exclude even the possibility of Russia challenging Moldova using cyber attacks. Russia has done it before. I wouldn't be surprised for Russia not doing again. So we have to provide in a more holistic way the support to the Moldovan government. Because look, what are we going to do if Russia organizes chaos over there? And of course, you know, Moldova is very close to Romania, which is a NATO member state. We better act now. Whether I see a full-blown like a conflict there, as of today, I don't. But it doesn't mean that this is not a serious security threat to the rest of Europe.
If we look across the border to Romania, the government there has been complaining recently about a misinformation campaign that's been running to try and get people to believe that Romanian troops have been massing at the border with Moldova. Then you look across to Kosovo and the government there has accused Russian mercenaries of working with Serbian paramilitaries to try and destabilize Kosovo too. What's the strategy here? Like, do you see Russia as pursuing the strategy of trying to destabilize multiple countries at once?
Kate, you're absolutely right. And you can precisely tell that it's the same playbook that they are using, blaming the West for organizing chaos inside those countries and then, you know, to challenge Russia. That's something that Russia has been doing even since like Georgia more than a decade ago. So we know the script. Well, we do not right now act upon that. We are not taking that thing seriously enough. The Balkans is very vulnerable in terms of religion, in terms of Russia knows how to exploit those vulnerabilities and differences. And then, you know, to put NATO on the defensive and to see, you know, whether NATO will act or not. So the playbook is absolutely the same. And we see that in Kosovo, I mean, the Balkans, what's happening in Montenegro, what's happening also in Bosnia. We also see what's happening in Moldova. We also see what's happening, for example, in Georgia. So that is the part of Russia's playbook. As I stated, the problem, you know, Kate, is that it's so invisible to many people. To understand how Russia operates through different blogs, through different influencers.
I found your argument in Politico in this article that you wrote last year really interesting, where you said that the West, namely the United States, should be trying to wage psychological warfare within Russia in response to all of these tactics you just described being used by Moscow. Can you explain a bit more about what you meant by that?
After the end of the Cold War, the United States abandoned, in my view, one of the most potent weapons that we have, which is soft power and information to win hearts and minds. And Russia never abandoned that. On the contrary, Russia has continued using that for its nefarious purposes. And what's happening right now in Russia, in terms of how Russia completely shut down the information space, many people think that we should not actually, you know, interfere in what's happening inside Russia. I disagree, because I firmly believe that in order to challenge Russia in the information space, you know, by building resilience in the West, making people aware, you know, what fake news are, etc., it's a great thing, but that's not enough. I think we should put Russia on the defensive and to exploit their vulnerabilities by telling the truth. Look, Russia just marked the 70th anniversary of Stalin, trying to rewrite the history. Stalin has become one of the favorite figures inside Russia's society. And real question is, how come that we have allowed something like that? Look, forget about spreading inside Russia the American dream. That's not going to work anymore. The Russian people right now, they do not believe in the Western concept of democracies. Actually, they think that all people who spread that, they're the threat to Russia. And even Russian people who believe that Russia should become more democratic, they're considered as their traitors. So in that particular piece, I actually argue how we should exploit Russian nationalism and to target a far-right groups and to tell them actually that Putin's war has degraded Russian greatness. They don't want to, you know, live in American dream. They want to live in Russian dream. And this might sound like a brutal to many people in the West, but I think, you know, that's a right approach to challenge this thing. I always like to say, look, Russia has been trying to weaponize secessions, as I just told you. People in Tatarstan, they have numerous problems with the rest of the Russian government, and they want to secede. We should help them, you know, to promote, for example, democracy over there and to tell them what they are losing from the Russian side. Then, for example, we should spread information related to, for example, the Russian Orthodox Church and to talk also how Russia is weaponizing religion and manipulating people inside Russia while Putin is sending people as a cannon fodder on the battlefield. Meanwhile, the Russian patriarch Kirill is wearing $40,000, you know, watch. So there are, you know, numerous ways that we can actually put Russia on the defensive. And some people say that's not going to work, that's not going to deter Putin. Well, even Russia has limited resources. So let's put Russia on the defensive. Let them spend their time, energy, and resources for defending themselves from our information operations instead of using their capacity to target us.
If you are interested in the murky ways in which Russia uses information warfare, you should absolutely head to Twitter and follow Ivana there. You can find her at Ivana Stradna. What have you been enjoying this week?
I went to see Tar.
Oh,
this week.
I imagine you've got lots of thoughts about this film.
Yeah, I do have a lot of thoughts about it. Have you seen it yet?
No, and I don't even know that much about it. What's the deal again?
Well, so this is a film that's winning Cate Blanchett lots of awards for her performance as the film's title character, Lydia Tar, who's a super successful orchestral conductor from the New York area, who has the top job of conducting the world's best orchestra, or one of the world's best orchestras, the Berlin Philharmonic. And Katie, before you attack me for doing that classic thing of talking about a film many, many months after everyone else has been talking about it, it's actually just come out this last weekend in the Netherlands. So I am at the cutting edge of Dutch culture this week.
Well done.
Basically, what I think about it is that everyone should see it. It's quite a long film, but it's so gripping. I have a lot of thoughts about it, especially as a classical musician myself and the son of a conductor. My father is fortunately a much nicer, less power-crazed person than the character Lydia Tar.
Glad to hear it.
But they got a lot really right in depicting this world that I know very well. And of course, some things totally wrong, as I'm sure is the case when anyone watches a film set in their own professional world. But I forgive the film because it's really gripping and it's made me think about lots of things that I'd not thought about before. It's one of those films where I'd been having conversations with people about the discourse around it for months without actually having seen it. And I went in like already with opinions about it, quite critical of Todd Haynes' decision to make a film about an abusive conductor and to make that conductor a woman, because there are just so few women conductors who have been allowed to get to the level of this fictional character, Lydia Tarr, if any, actually. And there are just so many abusive conductors who are men. But putting that aside, I still enjoyed it. And if you've seen it already, instead of listening to me witter on for any longer about it, because I could, can I please recommend you go and read Zadie Smith's essay in the New York Review of Books about this film? It's called The Instrumentalist. And Smith really just has an amazing ability to analyze things like this so brilliantly. She really dives into the generational divide at the heart of the film with such clarity. So yeah, go see the film and digest it with the help of Zadie Smith.
I will do that.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I've been enjoying two things that were recommended by listeners on our Patreon Facebook group. The first one is the Scottish film After Sun, which came out last year. And it is about a father and his young daughter going on holiday in Turkey in the 1990s. It stars Paul Mescal, who you might know as Connell from Normal People. And he is a great actor. It's a really sensitive portrayal, I think, of a young dad who is wrestling with some demons. He's also an Irish actor doing what Twitter says is a very decent Scottish accent. Correct me if I'm wrong, Scottish listeners. But the real star of this film is Frankie Corio, who plays his daughter. She's 13 now, but I think she was just 11 when they shot the film. And she is phenomenal. I've never seen a kid act that naturally before. It's really astonishing. And it's just a beautiful, poignant film about a father-daughter relationship. I won't say too much else apart from that. The other thing I liked about this film is the way it provides a quite cringy snapshot of these like British package holidays that people went on in the 1990s and still do, where all of these British people travel to stay for a week in a place occupied entirely by other British people. It's like you're in Britain, but with better weather. So big thanks to Paul Green for recommending After Sun. It is one of those, yeah, like beautiful, ambiguous films that you think about for a long time afterwards. And the other thing that I wanted to share this week is via our listener, Britta Shell in Lisbon. Again, second shout out for Britta this week. And it is a Lisbon radio station called Radio Olisipo. And it was founded a couple of years ago by two Italians living in the city. And it's a radio station that celebrates the music of Lisbon, not just musicians who were born there, but also immigrants who found themselves making music there, musicians who might just be passing through. And it's a very cool and eclectic mix. They play a lot of random album tracks that won't make it onto commercial radio. And I tuned in for a little bit this week and it was super, super good. Just loads of music that I wouldn't have heard otherwise. Great recommendation. Thanks, Britta.
Time for a happy ending, and this week's happy ending comes from a village not so far from where I live, a village called Aardenhout, just west of Haarlem in the Netherlands. This weekend, police were called up by a resident in this village who had spotted a suspicious man lurking around the village with wire cutters. The police jumped into action, closed off all entrances and exits to the residential area, and began a 45-minute long thorough search of the area to try and catch and stop this suspected burglar from breaking in anywhere. And they found the man. He was confronted by the police, caught in the glare of the police car's headlights, nowhere to go. But once they stopped him, they very quickly realized they weren't dealing with a burglar. They were dealing with the mayor of the municipality.
Oh no.
Who was out on his evening walk, not with wire cutters, as the caller had thought, but with one of those sticks you use to pick up rubbish.
Oh, he was the opposite of a burglar.
I know. The poor man sounded like he had a bit of a shock caught in the police headlights, but he also saw the humour in it and is now famous in the Netherlands for being a great guy and collecting rubbish, which is possibly the best publicity a mayor could ever hope for.
That's some fantastic guerrilla marketing. That's almost as good as the Toblerone thing.
Do you think it was a setup?
Maybe. we are, I'm sad to tell you, not here next week. Don't blame me, listeners. I have zero other commitments apart from this podcast. It's actually kind of sad. You should blame Dominic's over-successful singing career, because I think you've got yourself into another one of those crazy situations where you're singing like all day and all night for a week, right?
Yeah, I'm heading back to Northern Italy to finish working on a project I've been doing there in Bolzano. And yeah, it just wasn't possible to fit it within the schedule with a kind of incredibly long train journey there as well. No one wants to hear a podcast recorded on a train.
Nobody does. Well, Dominic, you are the hardest working man in opera, so we salute you for that. And we will atone for our absence the following week with an extra good episode. Don't miss it. In the meantime, we will be around on the internet. You can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod and Instagram at EuropeansPodcast.
This week's show was produced by Katie Lee and Wojciech Aleksiak. Thank you both. See you in 2 weeks, everyone. Bye.
Ozibuna.